wish you lived in a giant mansion and could afford luxurious cars with people to serve you night and day? Sure you do. We all do. Well, now you can. It's time to learn how to make money with your host, Danny Mula.
Hi, everybody. Can you believe I used to be poor? It's true. There was a time when I actually held a job. I'm talking 9 to 5, 5 days a week. I know it sounds crazy, but it's true. Well, not anymore. Now I know the secret of how to make money, and I'm going to share that secret with you. Here it is. I know what you're saying. Danny, that's a color copier. And you're right. But using today's technology, this color copier will make money for you faster than you ever dreamed possible.
I used to buy $1 lottery tickets hoping for that big break. That is until Danny Mula taught me that I could turn those $1 bills into millions right in my own home. Now I'm copying 50s and 100s and my income is skyrocketing.
Hey, open up. It's the police. We know you're in there.
Excuse me. I gotta run.
I know what you're saying. Danny, where am I going to get the money to get started? Well, that's what you'll find out when you order my new series of 30 cassettes.
To order Danny's new How to Make Money with a Color Copier, call 1-900-BIG-SCAM. Order now and we'll also send you the original How to Make Money Knowing the Telephone Numbers of a Few Colombian Drug Lords.
That's 1-900-BIG-SCAM. And watch for my upcoming infomercial, How to Make Big Money Selling Audio Cassettes. Bye-bye.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to The Limits of Power and the End of American Exceptionalism with Andrew Basevich. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Yes, sir.
Hi, my name's Adrian Angus. I'm a first-year law student here. And
how's
my
it
question
going?
my question is, if America's stops its expansionist foreign policy and its economic dominance that's attached to that, you're saying that it's not sustainable, it can't go forward. But if we change the way we live, would that also mean not taking out much debt and not having an expansionist foreign policy? So is it kind of a catch-22 that no matter which way we go, this era of American dominance militarily and economically is over?
Well, despite the fact that the stock market dropped another 500 points today, and that we face, I think, a tremendously grave crisis, it's not as if that we're on some sort of slide that within the next 5 or 10 years we're going to become the equivalent of Belgium. Not to insult anybody who comes from Belgium. We will certainly be a great power through the remainder of the 21st century. We will certainly continue to be probably the only nation that structures its military force in ways that allow us to give us a global power projection capability. But we just sort of need to give up on this notion that, you know, either we're number one or we're nothing. I was talking to a reporter today, and I can't remember how he posed the question, but the interview dealt with this question of American decline. And the question kind of revolved around, well, gosh, if we forfeit our primacy, who will take over? Who will have that role? And I said, well, I don't really know, but I'm not sure why we care. I mean, it's not as if you know, that being number one, that there's something that attaches to that status that gives you any significant greater capacity to respond to the needs of your people. So I sort of say, don't worry about who's number one, right? I mean, if the Red Sox, God forbid, but if the Red Sox, if the Red Sox lose the World Series this year and therefore are no longer number one in Major League Baseball, does that matter all that much to both? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It doesn't. To what Boston has to offer, or indeed to the problems that Boston confronts. So I think it's kind of a false measure, is what I'm trying to say in my awkward way. Yes, ma'am.
Yes. To the extent that you believe that the United States was a moral leader in the world, what do you think the United States can do in its foreign and domestic policy to regain this role, perhaps maybe with the use of soft power?
Well, I think it's easy to overstate the extent to which the United States has been the moral leader. On the other hand, I'm certainly not going to dismiss out of hand both the value of being perceived to be a moral leader, nor am I going to dismiss out of hand simply the importance of having certain values be supported and prevailed in our human existence while other values should be discarded and disappear. In my book, I try to use Reinhold Niebuhr as a touchstone of the argument that I make at various times. Many of you know who Reinhold Niebuhr was, a Protestant theologian, tremendously influential public intellectual in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, and even in the 1960s. And Niebuhr defined himself, as I define myself, as a realist when it comes to international politics, meaning, at the end of the day, nations behave in certain ways, not because they think it's right, but because they perceive their interest to be served by that behavior. And all nations conform to that view. Niebuhr said the essence of statecraft is to identify what he called points of concurrence between your own needs, your own interests, and the needs and interests of other nations. To pursue an agenda where you'll accomplish something that serves you while it serves them, and by God, that's where opportunities for collaboration exist. And so we should ask ourselves, I think, I am going to answer your question, we should ask ourselves, are there any points of concurrence between our interests and the interests of other nations and indeed interests of the rest of the world? And I think it's self-evident that there are points of concurrence. It's not difficult to think of them. One example would be the threat posed by climate change. I mean, some people in this room may disagree. I am not a scientist, but I am persuaded that there is a scientific consensus that global warming is real and that it's caused at least to some substantial degree by human activity. I'm also persuaded that if we just sort of pretend it's a minor phenomenon, there's going to be hell to pay in another 50 or 100 years. So we have a profound interest in beginning to address that problem. Guess what? Everybody else does too. If the United States is perceived to be, whether fairly or not, the United States is perceived to be a laggard in dealing with this issue, what would be the impact on our moral standing if the United States were perceived to be a leader on this issue? I think potentially it would be profound, although I'm not advocating that we tend to that problem so we could enhance our moral standing. I'm advocating that we attend to that problem because it really matters to the well-being of the next generation and the generation beyond that. So that's the way I would approach the problem. Yes, sir.
My name is Patrick, and I'm a sophomore in the College of Arts and Sciences. First, I'd like to say I very much enjoyed your lecture during the course Social Sciences last year.
Thank you.
But my question is, if the next president or a future president were to finally admit that this open-ended global war on terrorism was not the way to go,
yep,
and you were asked to advise on it, what would you say would be the first steps or the first actions we should take to change the way we're moving?
Yeah, obviously you can't just make the speech and say, my predecessor was really wrong. You have to say, my predecessor may have made some errors in judgment along the way, and I'm here to explain how we're going to do better going forward. So clearly, the articulation of the alternative would be, an immediate alternative would be just as important as acknowledging the defects of what we've done so far. My own sense, and this really goes back again to the question of what's the threat and how do we define the threat, I would see the threat, and I'm using the term threat here very loosely, I would see the threat manifesting itself in two ways. Number one is there are terrorist organizations who plot against the West and against us and who launch attacks, not just 9/11, but Madrid and London and so on. Well, how should we understand that threat? I believe we should understand that threat as a type of international criminal conspiracy, albeit one that is fueled by a religious fervor that, let's say, is absent from the mafia. But nonetheless, it's an international criminal conspiracy. Well, what do you do when you're faced with a criminal conspiracy? Well, what you do is you turn the cops loose. You act consistent, I hope consistent with the rule of law, and put together an international police response, which would emphasize not the kind of cops that are walking up and down Commonwealth Avenue, but intelligence agencies, national police agencies, FBI, MI5, and probably from time to time some special operations forces from the military. And the object of the exercise is to identify in detail that conspiracy and destroy it, root it out, either arrest the participants in the conspiracy or kill them. And the point here is, you don't need to invade and occupy countries to do that. Nor am I suggesting that that is an easy process or that it will happen over a six-month period of time. The elimination of that criminal conspiracy will take a long time, but if you view it as a police problem, as a criminality, then it seems to me that you'll come up with a solution that's both more affordable and more likely to yield success. The second way to view the threat, again emphasizing I'm using threat here very, very loosely, is that I think we have to acknowledge that that within many parts, not necessarily all parts of the Islamic world, there is a substantial amount of dysfunction that probably stems from a fundamental conflict between a definition of religiosity held by many that is wedded to tradition and the reality of modernity. And there's a great struggle for change and accommodation going on in the Islamic world, not unlike the struggle for change and accommodation that occurred within Western religious traditions a couple of centuries back. Well, they're going to have to figure it out. They're going to have to figure out how to make that accommodation. We cannot impose it on them. We can help on the margins. We can contribute on the margins. We can encourage liberal tendencies or contribute to humane tendencies. We can provide opportunities for education, for example. But we're not going to fix that dysfunction or address those pathologies, again, by invading and occupying countries. So there, I think the rule of thumb is, let Islam be Islam. Let them find their own way. Just try to ensure that over the period of time when they're going to make that accommodation with modernity, which will take a long time, that they won't harm us. That implies some way of reconfiguring or reconceptualizing a strategy of containment. Now, when you say containment, that immediately conjures up images of the Cold War, where the adversary is a unified adversary, like the Soviet Empire, relatively unified for a period of time. Conjures up images of NATO, you know, tanks guarding the Fulda Gap. When I say reconfigure or reconstitute containment, I don't mean that we need to apply the same methods toward the Islamic world, but we need to achieve the same effects with regard to the Islamic world that we achieved with regard to the Soviet Empire. Prevent them from expanding. Prevent them from harming us while they work out their destiny. That would be what I would want the next president to say. Words to that effect, at least. Yes, sir. Ready for this special combination. Mama Viper runs my knife. The older the people that fight for the equal rights and justice for all, you know. Yeah, listen, these people. Yes. Fight your revolution every day. Now forget your power and choose the better way. Fight your revolution every day. Now forget your power. Oh, yo, fight your revolution every day. Now forget your power. Choose the better way. Fight your revolution every day. Now forget your power. D'abitudine l'intatta verità, venduta agli occhi come inevitabile realtà. L'avere senza limite rende l'ego crimine. Ricorda non sei quel che hai ma quel che sei. Dimmi com'è, com'è che l'attitudine a decidere per noi. Forse non è, non è cambiato e sembra non voler cambiare mai. Si supera ogni limite, prezzo insostenibile. Attendo che si spenga la TV e si ascolti. Supera ogni limite il rendersi più simile, mai conforme alle vostre sagome. Fight your revolution every day. Now forget your power and choose the better way. Fight your revolution every day. Now forget your power. Long shisting get blind. Your reason fi confi your mind on them. Me tell you rise again. Them a think over your eyes. No one them can decide me say. Believe just in yourself. A fi transfer your mental weapons and go know me bread. Struggle a tough. Stay unite and a go red. Society a sick. No one a really rich. Can't no one a really free. Yeah. People keep your strength.
stand for defense, not give up on them. Rise up, rise up. Fighting for your future, remember this, you are the soldier. Peace in all the culture. Fight your revolution every day. Now forget your power and choose the better way. Fight your revolution every day. Now forget your power. Say no, people. Never give up in a struggle, you see. Bomb Babylon, shisting, bomb the corruption, bomb the politician, you know. We don't want more sufferation, you know. Bomb more clout.
Ci supera ogni limite, il prezzo insostenibile. Mai conformi alle vostre sagome.
Babylon, shisting, get blind. Your reason for confusion, your mind on them.
And now, back to The Limits of Power and the End of American Exceptionalism with Andrew Bacevich.
I remember it being a big problem for George Bush never coming up with an exit strategy, or not soon enough anyway. It was sort of the same thing as not clearly defining victory. But I understand that both Barack and McCain want to stay in Afghanistan or increase troop levels. Do you see any indication that either have a clear definition of victory, an exit strategy, an intention to leave, any of this?
Well, two things. Yeah. One is, this not to throw this back at you, I don't mean that, but this concept of this phrase, exit strategy, not useful, okay? In the sense that it seems to imply that war is an instrument over which I can exert rather precise control. The historical experience of war says that it's at a minimum very difficult to control and may well be impossible to control. So the notion that I'm going to go in and I'm going to go this far and I'm going to achieve just these things and then say, okay, got all the items checked off my list and now I'm going to leave, is not a useful way to think about war. Now, with regard specifically to Afghanistan, there are members of the faculty of our university who I hope are not here because they will know infinitely more about the history of Afghanistan than I do. The little I know persuades me that this is a place that, that has never been effectively governed from Kabul. That is to say, there's never been political authority in Kabul that exercised full control over the entire geographic expression of Afghanistan. And therefore, our effort to create a government that's going to exercise that kind of authority, tough problem, maybe undoable. 7.5 years into it, frankly, it's not going all that well. So rather than saying, send more troops to Afghanistan, we got to support President Karzai, we have to do all these things, my own sense is that we need to recognize what the history of Afghanistan tells us, and that is that political authority tends to be decentralized. Political authority tends to be exercised by people we call warlords, you know, tribal leaders and the like, and that perhaps there is a strategy to be found in empowering local leaders to do for us what we want. There'll also be a point of concurrence, empowering them to do what they want. What do they want to do? They want to exercise control over their own jurisdiction. Great. We should support that, so long as that control over their jurisdiction precludes any significant Taliban presence and activity. The truth is, all we really care about in Afghanistan is that it not be a base for Taliban and Al-Qaeda terrorist activity. If the tribal leaders do that for us, then that would be sufficient, and that would make it unnecessary for us to sustain this protracted U.S. military presence. Yes, sir.
Yes. Regarding Afghanistan and Iraq in particular, if we were to pull out, theoretically, and there's Russia, China, and Iran that comes to mind who could potentially fill that gap, what do you think the fallout would be economically to the United States and in a humanitarian sense to Afghanistan and Iraq?
When you say fill the gap, what do you mean?
The power vacuum that we would, in theory, leave if we were to, in the next however many years, begin to withdraw from this flawed strategy.
Well, I think we have to try to evaluate as realistically as we can the power that these actors have and the intentions. I'm not, it seems to me that it's highly likely that by the time we get to mid-century, China is going to be unambiguously a great power. But I don't see any evidence that the Chinese intend to run the world. I don't see any evidence the Chinese say, aha, the Chinese way. Everyone must live the Chinese way. I don't know of a single Chinese leader who has said Chinese values are universal values. There have been many American leaders who say American values are universal values, but I don't believe any Chinese political leader is insistent that somehow, you know, Confucius is going to have to be practiced or followed in South America. That doesn't mean they are benign. It doesn't mean that they're going to be our friend. It doesn't mean that our interests are going to always coincide with theirs. But I don't somehow see Chinese, the Chinese filling a power vacuum in the Middle East. Now, will the Chinese want to have access to Middle Eastern energy resources? You betcha, all right, as Governor Palin would say. Now, the Russians. Russia is back. That's the significance of the Georgia dust-up. Russia is back, okay? Russia is not the Soviet Union. Russia is a nationalist state. It is not a totalitarian state. Its motives, I think, are understood in terms of, ought to be understood in terms of traditional great power considerations. It's not ideological. The Russian army looks pretty good going up against the Georgians. Russian army does not pose a threat to Germany or Great Britain. So we need to not overstate the Russian threat. Does Russia have the capacity to fill some Middle Eastern power vacuum? I really doubt it. Iran, well, different kettle of fish. We have facilitated the rise of greater Iranian power through our misguided adventure in Iraq. I don't know that there's any way to easily undo that. Iran does not pose an existential threat to the United States. If Iran acquired a nuclear weapon, would they pose an existential threat to some of our allies, to include Israel? One would have to take that very seriously. But one would also have to, I think, look very carefully at the way you deal with nuclear threats in the modern world. And that has tended to be through deterrence. And deterrence has, by and large, proven to be relatively effective. Now, there's a response to that. The response is, Ahmadinejad is a lunatic. He is a madman. He really wouldn't care if Iran were blown to smithereens in a nuclear confrontation. I don't mean to be glib, but I don't believe that. I believe that he would be constrained by a credible threat. And we have it within our capacity to make threats like that. Quite frankly, the Israelis are probably even more credible in their threats, because if there's one nation in the world I think that really would pull the nuclear trigger, it's the Israelis. Not because they're bad, but they take national security very, very, very seriously. And that's why they would also be very effective in deterring Iranian misbehavior, I think. Is there certainty? Nope, there's no certainty at all. It's a matter of calculations. Yes, ma'am. What time do we finish? I'm only saying that because I'm getting tired. Okay, should we make this be the last question?
What I would like to know is what you think about the importance that oil played in the invasion of Iraq and the war on Google.
Sure. the role of oil. It would be, I guess it would be reassuring in a way, because it would make everything so black and white and simple if we could say, yeah, Bush, oil man, Cheney, oil man. They got together in the Oval Office one afternoon and said, ah, Iraq, oil, let's go for it. Because we would be able to say, God, they're just a couple of crumb bums and, you know, just, that's not the way it is, right? We didn't invade Iraq to get the oil. The oil was already available. I mean, it was already being produced for the global market. Having said that, it's certainly true that were it not for the oil, that is to say, that were it not for the fact that such a large percentage of the world's oil reserves happen to exist in the Persian Gulf, we wouldn't care any more about the Persian Gulf than we care about Antarctica. It would have zero strategic significance. Not zero. They still have the Suez Canal. But I mean, it would have very little strategic significance. Because the world economy runs on oil, because we have, for decades, on the one hand, recognized that oil dependence is a problem, and on the other hand, refused to do anything about it, over time, the strategic significance of the Persian Gulf has come to be ever greater and ever greater. So it is a war about oil in the sense that oil lends to the Persian Gulf its strategic importance. It's not a war about oil in the sense that the proximate or immediate or narrow purpose of the invasion was to get the oil. Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed this.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Rush Limbaugh. I still have a few fans left. Now, as you know, I've been going through a tough time lately. I had to resign my position at ESPN due to some controversial remarks that I made about Philadelphia Eagles quarterback Donovan McNabb. Apparently, he's black. Who knew? And before I check into rehab, I asked the producers of this show if I could read a brief statement. As America knows, I am high. Lee-rated among radio broadcasters. The days ahead will be difficult, but I refuse to wallow in self-pity or crawl into bed with a 14-year-old. Bottle of scotch. But a botched back operation has left me in excruciating pain, which my big ass, per in supply, could not stop. Wow, this has given me a headache. Oh, I wish I was on Oxycontin. Hard times then would be forgotten. Look away, look away, look away, Limbaugh fans. The liberal media is out there plotting. Want me in a jail cell rotten. Lock away, lock away, lock away, this great man. Oh, I once said lock drug users away, away, but now you'll find I've changed my mind, and I can't blame Slick Willie. Some say hooray and pray I'll be convicted. What's new? I'm through. You knew I was a dick. Ted.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.